This is the Dharma Podcast at dharmapodcast.org, and this is show number 185. It was recorded November 11th, 2009, and it's titled Lift Every Voice.
That peace walk was scheduled to end in Boston after traveling all over the state of Massachusetts, and that did happen to be the day of the beginning of our hostilities in Iraq. It was quite amazing to put out the word about this, that this walk was coming through, and we had more press than I have ever seen. We had a peace walk. We had more people and more anguish than I've ever felt in a peace walk. So it was really quite something. I'd forgotten that was our first meeting. I am really proud and honored to be here. I've been hearing about the Upaya Zen Center for many, many years. I can't tell you how many years. And always hoped to visit and never quite expected to be visiting in this role. So I'm very honored. Also to be part of, I know that even just to visit Santa Fe is quite an honor as well, especially for someone who's been a writing teacher since the 1960s, because you have such wonderful, wonderful writing teachers associated with this city. And I hope some of you are writers or aspiring writers. I hope all of you are aspiring writers because we really, really need your voices out there right now. Peace marches are one thing, but we also have so much work to do to change attitudes, to shift beliefs, to change institutions, as well as to stop the destruction and minimize the destruction that's going on so many fronts in our world. This is Veterans Day today, and I learned in a brief visit to the internet that there's a new report has just come out in Cambridge, Mass, saying that 2,266 veterans under the age of 65 have died in the past year due to a lack of health care. And this is something like four times more than died in the same period in both Iraq and Afghanistan. So just one of the many issues that we need to think about, feel about, and speak about.
Well, thank you very much. That's lovely.
I have other things I'm going to get out of my bag later. What I wanted to do tonight is to speak a little bit, take these off for now, speak a little bit about my work and what I do, combining these things of activism, writing, and teaching, and to invoke some of my teachers as well, and then to tell a story, a very personal story that came to me today while I was taking a walk on your beautiful hillside, and then to ask you to do something together, which probably doesn't always happen in a Dharma talk, but it will involve some work in pairs, sharing something, and then we'll have some discussion and possibly some more stories told about this. My title that I gave when I accepted this invitation was Lift Every Voice, and every is in capital letters. And you may know that Lift Every Voice is the African American national anthem. Lift Every Voice and Sing. And that's very meaningful to me, and as will come out, I hope, in the talk. So let me say a little bit about how I got here and how I came to write this book. The book is called Undoing the Silence. And it's a, in some ways, a, I thought it was going to be a culmination of my teaching of writing for many, many years. I started teaching at University of California in 1964. And anybody that goes back that far will remember that that was the year of the free speech movement on that campus. So I was a graduate student then, and I was a teaching assistant in a writing course. And right around us, the world became polarized. And people had to make a decision whether to go on strike for freedom of speech on the campus or not. And it just brought everyone into a place where they had to think, and they had to think carefully, and they had to figure out how to communicate what they thought in a way that others would hear. That was quite difficult. But it was, it was the best year teaching I ever had, because I was teaching a freshman composition, and we did some writing about civil disobedience, and everybody had strong feelings and opinions about it. And it was a transformational time where everyone in the whole class wrote exciting, wonderful stuff. There was nobody that was alienated or lost or hanging back or writing something just because they thought the teacher would appreciate it. It was coming from the heart. And so all my life as a teacher, I wanted to recreate that situation as much as I could. And to some extent, I have been fortunate to find a lot of people to work with as a teacher who are willing to open up, take risks, and speak their truth. Over the years, I won't give you my whole biography, but I've taught in a number of universities, including MIT, which was really a place where there was a lot of need for speaking up. When I left that job and went into retirement, I was able to work more with community groups and peace groups and environmental groups, activist groups. And that was when I began to assemble the stories that went into my book, Undoing the Silence. It's not just my teachings, it's people's stories of actually undoing their silences. Now, I guess I spend a lot of time thinking in the book about what it is that causes these silences. Why do we silence ourselves? Why do we not feel comfortable to speak up? And so as I was thinking about these things and coming up with the title for the book, I was also following a path that led me to becoming receiving the transmission of what we call in the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition the 14 mindfulness trainings, one of which is about similar to right speech. So, and when I received those trainings, I received a Dharma name. And my Dharma name had a lot of resonance with the title of my book, but not exactly an easy resonance. My Dharma name is True Silent Teaching. True Silent Teaching. And here I was about to publish a book called Undoing the Silence. So I think there's a lot to chew on here. And I'm still thinking about it, still chewing on it, still working on it. I guess you find that we tend to have these life issues. When to speak, when to be silent, how to speak, how to listen as part of speech. And we tend to end up teaching the things that we need to learn about. So that has been my story, and that's what brought me here. When the book came out, I had many more opportunities to teach what I needed to learn about, not only because of, you know, a tiny bit of publicity. It's from a small publisher, so it's not like the whole world doesn't know about this book yet. It's from a small publisher, but Many people do know about it, and I've received some really fascinating invitations to give workshops and talks, this being one of them. So that has happened. But at the same time, the world has become more challenging. In some ways, the book, I keep putting these on because I think I'm going to look at my notes, but it's more interesting to look at you. So we'll hope that the notes are embodied in me and that will come out what I intend to say. Sorry, I got distracted there. The world has gotten more challenging. The book came out really at a perfect time when just about 2 years ago, at a point when I would say that silencing in our country, in our culture, had reached an apex that it had not reached before, since perhaps the Cold War or the 50s, where lots and lots of people were terrified about speaking out, and people were losing their jobs. I collected stories of a Veterans Administration nurse who wrote a letter to the editor about the horror she was seeing among veterans from the Iraq War, and she was suspended from her job. Things like that were happening and still are happening and probably always will happen. But at the same time, people were very bravely realizing that if we don't speak up, if we don't take some action, we know that things are only going to get worse. So I was able to play a small role in encouraging people. That's been my work. And to see that as we got more courage in our powers of speaking out and taking action, that we were able to elect a different kind of president, very different kind of president. And of course, he's a wonderful president that has so much to offer, but with many of his policies, health care, war in Afghanistan, what to do about the economy, most of the activists will say this is not really helping us enough. But the beautiful opportunity is that this president encourages us to speak up and really is an ally in helping us to speak up. So there's so much that we can do. I want to thank many other teachers who've helped me in this time, and one of them is Joanna Macy, who I know is going to be coming here in March, I think it is, and doing a workshop here. I strongly encourage people to attend if they haven't already worked with Joanna. Just for those that don't know her work, she is a Buddhist practitioner, and she is also a systems theory scholar with a PhD. But for 35 years, I believe it is, she's been offering workshops to help people deal with the fear and despair and all the negative feelings that come up when you really look at what is going on in our world. It's time for a breath. I'm really looking at it as I say that. And Joanna has a way of building community around that that is really encouraging and empowering. And she sees that we're in an amazing moment when the old system, what she calls the industrial growth society, everything for industrial growth, profit, and development, is crumbling. It's crumbling at our feet. It's falling apart environmentally. It's falling apart economically. And the human despair and disaster that's being caused is enormous. But at the same time, Joanna sees that we are and can be part of a great turning, what she calls the great turning, which is to restore the values of sustainability, of our love of the earth, our connection with other human beings. And everything that we do can play a role in this. We can stick together. We don't need to be fearful about it. We have to do it. So writing can play a role in this too. And I've taken that on as my little piece of it to try to encourage people to use their writing for these actions. Now, Joanna has three levels of action that she sees, and writing can be a part of all of them. One is holding actions. And we all know what holding actions are. Demonstrations are holding actions. Writing letters to your congressperson are holding actions. Things to try to stop and minimize the disaster that's going on. And there's a certain problem when writing about holding actions. You kind of get involved in the dualism of it. It's either pro or con. So there's an issue there, and people can get a little bit burned out. But holding actions are a very legitimate and important part of this work. The second level is changing institutions. So institutions have to change. And so everybody that's working to build an earth-centered or feminist consciousness in some kind of institution is working on the great turning. I actually feel that to come here, I don't need to say this, because this center itself embodies that kind of work on new institutions that can help to transform our lives and our practice and our way of dealing with the world. So the final level, which I think is very promising for writers, is to work at shifting consciousness, because none of the changes will last unless there are major shifts of consciousness. And I see this every day with people who want to stop. Well, I just got an email today from someone who's giving talks about Gaza in the South. And it being Veterans Day today, he went out and there was a march. And it was people who sincerely supported the mission, not just supporting troops, but supporting the mission of the troops and supporting war as a solution to solving problems. So without a change in that kind of consciousness, we have no hope of changing the war machine at all, no matter who is president. And certainly it's one major reason why our current president can't do more than he can do, because consciousness has not changed yet. So how can we do this in small ways, in large ways, with our writing? Now, to backtrack a moment, I often, when I give workshops, I use the tool, I spend most of my time with the tools that I am now considering to be the Santa Fe tools, the tools that Natalie Goldberg and Julia Cameron have shared with the world, and all around the world people know these tools, which are tools for finding ways that you can break through your own silences and put into words, put into writing, things that you had forgotten, that you hadn't known, truths that are buried very deeply, and that you can find the language, the powerful detail that will make these truths cogent and engaging and appealing and powerful. So those are the Santa Fe tools. I'm not going to stress those tools tonight, because I feel that anybody here has probably already had some experience with them. I hope so. Or at least you have the teachers at hand to work with that. So the tools that I would like to work with have to do with balancing what you do when you go deeply and are able to state your truths with how to make those truths heard by others. How to engage with your audience. And I want to pause for a moment here and thank another teacher of mine. You might know her as Hilda Gutierrez Boldoquin. She has the Dharma name of Riomon. She's a Zen priest. And she was editor of a book called Dharma, Color, and Culture that came out about maybe 5 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, which is a collection of writings by American Buddhists who are people of color and who have experiences that don't get heard very often. So Brimon was giving a retreat a couple of years ago for my Sangha in Boston, the Old Path Sangha, in which we were attempting to think about race and class and privilege in our own Sangha. And this has nothing to do with this quote that I'm going to give you from Riamon, but she said something that really penetrated for me. She said, we are only useful where we understand how we are understood. We are only useful where we understand how we are understood. So the tools that I want to talk about tonight stem from that. How do we understand how our words affect others? How do we come to understand that? Because we do need to speak our truth. We do need to come from the heart. We do need to speak spontaneously and freely and express our truth. But if we want to be effective in the great turning, we want to change minds and hearts, we want to shift consciousness, we have to know who we're speaking to. And this is hard for a number of reasons. Most of us haven't thought very much about who we're talking to. And sometimes when we do, it shuts us right down. I've never heard Natalie in a workshop say, write this for your mother, or write this for your teacher, or write this for someone else. It's writing to express what's in your heart. And as soon as you have the audience entering in, you can scare yourself. You can really scare yourself. So it's not the first step. It's something you do after you've done the work that you would do with Natalie. It's something that you do afterwards to think about, well, how could I translate this for some people who could be affected by it, who could be changed by it? So many of us don't want to think about audience, and we don't know how to think about audience, and we're a little bit vague when we do, or we think, I'm going to write this for the general populace, and really the general populace is a whole lot of different groups of people with different ways of thinking. And which ones do we want to listen to us? Which ones do we want to change? How do we want to be heard by those people? How can we understand them well enough to get them to hear us so that they can be opened to what our story is, what we have to say? So a lot of this comes from listening and understanding those others, and from addressing some of the misperceptions that we might have about others, about another audience. And I'll give you an example of this in a minute, one that's very close to home. But just to explain what I mean about misperceptions, it's very easy. Maybe I will give a brief example that's not close to home. It just comes from a workshop that I gave recently. This was a workshop that I gave in Cambridge for people who wanted to do yoga and writing together. And it had a social change element, but that wasn't the main purpose of it. And we worked for three days together. Someone else was teaching yoga. I was leading writing exercises. And we did a lot of work that Natalie Goldberg does. And it was very empowering. People were feeling very good. And then we decided to write something that would really be part of the great turning, that could bring some change somewhere. So one woman decided that she wanted to write. She was very excited about a project. She was a teacher of English as a second language. to adult learners in a public university in the Boston area. And she had introduced mindfulness practice into her writing class and was just very excited with how breathing, meditation, but she didn't call it that, she called it mindfulness practice, how these things had brought a kind of centeredness and calm to her students that enabled them to be more peaceful and to do their writing more effectively. So she wanted to propose, she wanted her writing project was to propose a presentation where she shared this strategy with other teachers. But she wasn't trying to go out and change the world. She simply wanted to tell other teachers how mindfulness practices had affected her students, and she wanted to bring the students into the work, to the presentation as well. So it was going to be a joint presentation. This sounds wonderful, doesn't it? And you, to me, it sounded like, well, the teachers are really going to want to hear this. But she was quite worried about writing the proposal. And when she wrote it, it came out, in spite of all the work we had done to free the voice and everything, it came out very academic sounding. And it had big, long sentences, lots of words, lots of names of Dharma teachers, lots of which probably the teachers in the university would not know about. Lots of sort of apologies for the work, and it was difficult. Well, so it turned out that she was quite nervous about writing for other teachers, feeling that she would not be respected, that her work wouldn't be honored, that people would say, oh, that's just touchy-feely, oh, that's just whatever, and that she just had a very hard time writing from the heart about this heartfelt practice that she wanted to share. So we used some of the tools in my book, and I won't go into exactly what we did, but we had a listening group and people role-played some of her actual audience. And she found out what were the things in what she did write that really touched people. And she began to understand how she was understood. And then she went home and wrote another one that, instead of starting with all the facts about mindfulness meditation, she started with she only had, I think it was 200 words, so she had to be very brief, one of the challenges of this writing. But she was able to put in just enough of a little story about her students that the things that people had loved in the first draft became the center, they came first, and they became the center. And she used I and we instead of the third person and the passive verbs. And suddenly, her short little piece had a voice, it had life. And it was wonderful. She sent it to us afterwards on the internet, and we all gave some more feedback to it, and then she sent it in to the powers that be and let us know that it was accepted. Mm-hmm. So I guess the reason I tell you that is so many times in the academic world, people have a fear of judgment, and they have a fear of being shot down or a fear of not being respected, not being listened to. So the most important parts of their message get repressed. And I think that's true for other audiences as well. So that is what I mean. And I'd like to take a look at my watch here, if you'll excuse me. I meant to have it in front of me when I was talking and see just how much time I have to tell my next story. Not too much. My goodness. The time flies. Well, this is the one I have to tell, because this is the one that really comes from the heart. Somehow I wanted to tie, Maya had mentioned the peace walks today, And I had wanted to find a way to tie peace walking in with writing for social change. And I found a way to do it. How to talk to the challenging audience. How to make the message something that people can understand. So I have to tell you that I grew up in a family on the West Coast my mother was from the South, the U.S. South. She was from Tennessee. And I think she had kind of escaped from the South because she was very different from all of her relatives. Whenever we went to visit her relatives, they would... We would have family arguments about slavery. Now, this was in the 1940s and the 1950s, so it was well over by then. But somehow there were arguments about the right and wrong of the Civil War. And so everything was very dualistic. Now, my family had a lot of lawyers in it, so they were very good at argumentation. They were very good at... shooting down someone's argument. But of course, it didn't change anybody's heart or mind in that family. My younger sister, one of my sisters, became a lawyer. But she was especially good at this. And she got a reputation in the family for really being a very bad girl because she always talked back to her elders about the Civil War and about slavery and about racism and prejudice. And I was more silenced in those days. That's why I have this issue with silencing. I didn't say much. I stayed a good girl. I didn't try to challenge the family. But that's the background of this. Now, fast forward many years later, the year that I turned 60, I decided to go on a peace walk that focused on racism and slavery. It was led by the same Buddhist order that Maya mentioned. It has a base in Massachusetts. And the goal was to walk from Massachusetts all the way down the coast of the U.S., visiting sites in the slave trade and in the history of slavery. It was partly organized jointly by this Buddhist group and by some African Americans, particularly a Buddhist practitioner who's African American. So it wasn't as though it was just Buddhists doing this. It was a very amazing group of sometimes more than we are in this room who would be walking down the highway for 20 miles a day, a very mixed group, walking through many communities, stopping at sites of slave markets, learning the history, going to graveyards that had been obscured, meeting leaders in the community, learning about every aspect of slavery and the slave trade, and particularly what it is in the heart. So I went on it in part because of my own family. And wanting to revisit that history, our intention, our aspiration on this was to heal begin to heal the history of slavery for white people, for black people, and for all people. And it was very difficult. I'm not going to go into the ardors of the trip, but just imagine going with 50 people down the highway, getting very tired walking all day, 20 miles in the heat, summer, and not having really worked out our own relationships with each other. All the issues, we realized after a while that we were a microcosm of everything that slavery had spawned. And so there was a lot of opportunity to practice loving speech and deep listening and to try to understand the other within our group. So it was like I had a lot of transformation on that group during that walk. But one of the amazing synchronistic things that happened for me was I was in an area where I knew that my family had lived before moving to Tennessee. And before going on the trip, I had studied and made copies of parts of a book that my grandfather had proudly written about my grandmother's family history, including wills, from the wills that people had left, passing down enslaved people to their children by name. So I had these wills in my luggage. Now, on one evening, I met a gentleman who was from the same area, the same county, and he was researching his ancestors too. He was African American. His name was Dr. Bates. And my name is Louise Dunlap. There was no clue of what was to follow, but when we started talking about it, I said, well, I had family in that area too. And he said, oh, what was their name? And I said, McCollum. And he said, no. And that was his family's name as well. So I had contact, and I had already determined that it was a very unusual name in North Carolina of Scots people who came over. Anyway, those were my people. And his ancestors were also named McCollum, so there must have been a connection. So we got up, we hugged each other, and we made arrangements to share what we knew about our families. And he had a beautiful photograph of his ancestors. And I had these wills explaining how his ancestors had been passed down to my ancestors. And I gave them the wills. And this was very important, as it turned out, because one of the things we learned on this journey is how difficult it is for people of African descent in this part of their history to trace their ancestry, because their names were given to them, their last names, their African names were lost. So to find out anything about themselves prior to recent memory is very difficult. So these wills would be helpful to him. So this just changed my life, really, having had this experience with Dr. Bates. After my part of the journey, I walked for 2.5 months, which was not the whole journey by any means. They went on for actually 13 months. The whole journey was 13 months, and it ended in West Africa, which was another story that I would love to tell, but other people will tell that story. And we all had amazing stories. So after the journey, I decided that before the journey, I had written to all my southern relatives who were still alive. My mother isn't, but my aunt was, her sister, and an uncle and some cousins. And I had to give a lot of thought to how they would understand me when I wrote that letter. And I didn't want to fall into the trap of saying, I think our family played a very bad role in slavery and I want to go make amends and whatever. I wasn't going to do that, but what would I say to them? It hadn't been easy, and I think I had said something about, I'm going on this journey, I know you may not understand it, but I would really like your prayers and your support, because I want to understand more deeply what our family history is. Well, I did understand it more deeply after I met Dr. Bates and was able to exchange this information with him. So afterward, I had planned to come home by way of Tennessee and have a visit with my aunt, my mother's one remaining sister, who had never been particularly easy for me to communicate with, but I wanted to, and I felt full of love from this journey. One thing Maya didn't mention is this order of monks and nuns from Japan chants the first lines of the Lotus Sutra constantly while walking, and beats small drums. So you have a prayer in your head all the time. And the essence of it, as I understand it, is respect for all beings. Respect for all beings. And I think that's at the heart of communication across difference with challenging issues. Respect. So I think I had built up a little bit of it for my aunt when I came to see her. And I thought, the first night I was at her house, I think I was there 3 nights. the first night I'm just back from this journey, and she asks how it is, and I tell her as much as I can. And I decide I'll tell her about Dr. Bates. So I did. I told her about giving him the wills from our family book. And I could tell right away that that was a very risky thing to do. I could tell that I was not understood quite the way I wanted to be, because she had great Southern manners. She remained sweet and calm and pleasant, but I could tell that she was upset and hurt that I had given these papers to a stranger, especially to a black person, especially to someone who was descended, had the same name that we had, so probably was descended from us in some way. So I didn't go into all that, but I just backed away a little bit from the subject and let it rest. And I felt awkward that I had done that, and I didn't really know what to do, but I went about my visit and tried to cultivate loving kindness and respect for my aunt and appreciate what it was about her that I loved, and listened to a lot of stories about our family and these different possessions of theirs that she had in her house and how much she loved them and her son and all of that. And by the time I was ready to leave, she called me over and she said, "Louise, there's something I want to tell you." She said, "You gave those papers to that man," she said, "and I was really upset about that. But I left out a key piece here. When I saw that she drew back and didn't want to hear that, I said, "Well, Aunt Jean, I did that because you may not know this. I didn't realize this, but people of African descent are not able to trace their family histories. They're cut off from their families. And this was information that they can use. And I wanted to provide, I thought I really ought to provide it." So I just left it at that. So as I was about to leave, she called me in for a last cup of tea and she said, "Louise, I want you to know something. I was very upset by what you told me, but I prayed about it every night that you were here. I had trouble sleeping. I was thinking about it. And eventually I started to think, to me it means so much to know who my ancestors were. Mm-hmm. I take so much pleasure. I've been telling you about our ancestors. I take so much pleasure in it. If other people need to know who their ancestors are, I would never deny them that privilege. And I'm glad you gave that man those papers." And I was just so touched, because I had no idea that change could work in her in this way. I think, stereotyped her, in spite of all my good intentions, as someone who just could not, was too old-fashioned to change, was too attached to those traditions. So you can be surprised, you can be pleasantly surprised when you have fear of an audience. You can be very pleasantly surprised. You can't know right away. Now, that's the end of my story. I haven't written about this story yet, but it's one of those very powerful stories that comes up, and I think probably everyone in this room may have a story like that. Maybe not exactly like that, but had we been in more of a workshop setting, I would have asked you to think for a minute about something that keeps you from talking about challenging issues with challenging audiences. And then I would have asked you to think about a time when you had been able to communicate with a challenging audience. about a challenging issue, whether it be through loving kindness, listening, understanding them in a deeper way, or whatever way you were able to do it. And had we been in a workshop setting, we would have explored this a lot with each other and probably learned a lot from each other's stories. So that's not what we're going to do tonight, because it's almost the end of the Dharma talk. I was hoping, it's probably too much the end of the Dharma talk, but your voices haven't been heard at all in the Dharma talk. So I think there might be time for maybe two questions. Not long answers, but just two questions or comments that you would like to make about all of this. Yes.
I feel paralyzed by the intense polarization. Like, I feel helpless in that environment.
I hear you. I don't have an easy answer for that. I just drove through Tennessee again, and I was not with my family, but I was a guest at some very dear people's homes who had, I won't go into how I was related to them, but they were very kind and very sweet people, very deep practicing Christians, and the old friend of mine who had brought me there told me that one of them had changed churches in the middle of the election because the preacher was too often praising Senator Obama, and he just couldn't bear it. So I know what you mean about the polarization, but the answer to it is, one answer to it is, we have to get close and understand what else is in the hearts of the people that are polarized. I almost want to go back there. Now that I know this about these people, I had no idea. And have more conversation with this man. He's my entree into the world that I feel is so polarized. You know, the red and the blue. As we're fearful of that polarization, but it isn't always what we think it is. There's more to it. The other answer, maybe other people have good answers for this. The other answer to the paralysis is, don't address your polar opposite in your writing or your action. Find somebody else to address. Don't think that you have to go up against the most challenging audience. That just adds to the adversarial quality of, and makes it almost humanly impossible to practice deep listening and loving speech. I know I once sat in on some Dharma talks by Yvonne Rand in your tradition. She's at, or was anyway then, at the San Francisco Zen Center. And I was kind of asking questions like you have asked, and she said, don't practice with small things. Practice with simple things. Practice with things you can handle. Don't attempt to debate the Bush family. Or something like that.
What if that is your family?
Good question. What if that is your family? And my family, in a way, I thought was just about the same way. Maybe there's some, I don't know, I can't speak about your family yet. But I know we all, practicing with our families is sometimes the most important practice. It doesn't seem very glamorous. But how can you practice listening? How can you practice stopping? And I didn't go into all this, but the The basic practice is stopping and calming, listening, finding something you can empathize with, finding common ground, starting with the common ground. And if you have a family, I guess that's a great Dharma teacher for you. We do a lot of bowing in my tradition. We bow whenever we speak, whoever we speak, honoring the Buddha nature in each person. So I might start doing a lot of that. Is there one other question?
Just one here, Louise.
Oh, yes, thank you.
Thank you. This is actually quite an evening for me. I realized during the talk that this is an anniversary that I didn't come prepared to address, but your talk in some way really touched. I've spent the last 20 years developing expertise, being a criminal justice expert, speaking to the most difficult audiences. And 11 years ago, actually tomorrow, my younger brother was murdered. And I then went and found his killer 2 years ago and did a one-on-one reconciliation with him and wrote a book about it. And in that book, I told the truth that I really wanted to tell, because I felt a certain loneliness in when people address violence and try to talk about reconciliation. I didn't find that there was an honest description of the original wound of the violence. So I did that in this book, and then I worked backwards through both my brother's history and the killer's history, and came forward with a reconciliation. And what I got was from publishers, this is too much. So it was a gatekeeping function that stopped me. It was external, when I felt I'd spent my whole life preparing to tell the whole truth skillfully. And what does one do face to face with an external gatekeeper that turns out to be more powerful than the face of violence? I don't know the answer.
I don't know the answer either, but I had a lot of gatekeeping difficulties with my book, which I'm only just grasping at straws to try to answer. Your question is so profound that I feel almost inadequate, but I did have a lot of trouble with gatekeepers, and I didn't find a publisher for about 7 years. And only then, after 9/11, after it became a little bit easier to name the silencing, and to name, because it was out there, it was clear. I could in my proposals, I could cite examples of it that were in the public mind. So times changed a little bit, and the book became more in sync with what publishers have their protocols, and they're very restrictive, I think, mostly. On the other hand, I also worked a lot with a writing group during that time, to hear how I was being understood by people not already part of my dialogue, and I was able to modified some things, many things, not to bow down to the gatekeepers, not to get under the gate, but to make it more accessible and understandable. It's amazing how much you don't know about how other people read your words. And I would love to read your book and be involved in thinking about that with you.
Oh, we'd be so grateful.
Yeah. I think we need to move to a different dimension, because you're really expecting for this to end at 6:30 and there's dinner for people I think are invited to stay. And I, there are a few books that I have of my book for sale, and I'm happy to sign some of them in another room somewhere off to the side. So I would I think it deserves a deeper conversation, what we're having. Mm-hmm. Everything that people have spoken really excites me. I would like to go deeper into what you're saying, and I see on many faces a lot more to go into, so we'll have to do that sometime. Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you all very, very much.